Some of you were new from Kendall Giles, just finished up at Johns Hopkins University. The previous talk, this whole semester-long workshop is knowledge and search engines. So the previous talk was on just a simple demonstration of the Google search engine, the Google PageRank formula. And so this talk is just a simple, what I'm calling a canonical example of a knowledge discovery engine. And again, these two talks are just to kind of throw out some ideas to get people thinking, because we have people from a large number of different backgrounds and different viewpoints. And so maybe this will give folks a target to throw things at for the rest of the semester and the follow-on talks. So I was talking someone is going to be talking about, I hope, the small world phenomenon. I was talking with someone who happened to have been in one of my classes a couple years ago at William & Mary, and he was wondering whether, he's talking about working and going to school at the same time. And if you have the chance to work on your PhD, for example, while working in industry full time or trying to get both done at the same time, that's obviously problematic. People told me not to do that, and I promptly ignored their advice, so you feel free to ignore my advice not to do it. But I did end up, after doing that PhD work thing at the same time while living in a different state, I did end up with a pretty interesting story, and that's kind of a motivation for this talk. So while I was, or actually before I started going to school, I was in industry at a large defense contractor. And everything was pretty good. I had a little Dilbert cube, and I was doing my engineering tasks, and I was pretty happy. And at a defense contractor, every once in a while, they would bring in the customer, and there'd be a lot of pomp and ceremony to show the customer the products or the prototypes that people have been working on. Everyone tries to make a big hoo-ha about it, I guess, much like what faculty members do. But so they try to impress the customer to give them more money. And so I'd see these demonstrations, and it was kind of a good time. You got to meet a lot of interesting people, and got to talk to a lot of different customers and what they want. Everything was going great until September 11th happened, 6 years ago today. After September 11th, things changed a little bit. They still had the customers coming through and the pomp and ceremony, but I also started seeing from my little Dilbert cube a different type of customer. These customers, they didn't make a lot of celebration and noise about when the customer came to visit. The customer, they would just kind of go into their little room and have discussions about what I don't know. They weren't wearing trench coats, but there was an air of mystery about these customers who were coming through after September 11th. And so I got really curious. I had to know what was going on. So I got myself transferred into that group. And the group name had the word surveillance in the title. And so I got to sit on one of these customer meetings. And the customer would come in, and he threw out a CD. And said, "Can you guys tell me if there's anything interesting on this CD?" We said, "Well, what's on the CD?" He said, "Well, there's text. There's computer network traffic, there's audio, there are images. Okay, well, what are we looking for? You tell me." Okay. This customer had a need for us to find things of interest on this CD. Where did it come from? Can't tell you. So that was pretty interesting. Could we find something of interest that this guy knew about that we didn't, on the CD, full of a variety of data? And he wanted this his customers. His customers were analysts who would oftentimes be sitting in a room, maybe it was a closed room, and a big pipe of data would be coming into the room, and the analyst would have to be sort through this large amount of data and try to pick out these nuggets of information, find interesting patterns that would be of use to them for whatever their job was. And maybe they would tag it or flag it and send it on its way. So this guy who came in with this CD wanted us to be able to define and discover knowledge. Didn't have templates to look for. And he just wanted it done. Could we do that? And that kicked off me going back to school. I wanted to learn more about that. And so that's what I ended up pursuing. Coming up with some sort of knowledge discovery algorithm for finding information and data. How to do that? Well, I look for guidance to the physicists. And they have an algorithm for solving problems, all problems. I thought, hey, it's great. I will get out of this place sooner, my dissertation. And first step of the algorithm is to write the problem down. Second step is to think very hard. And the third step is to write down the answer. So I thought, okay, I'll try that in the knowledge discovery realm. Can I replicate that? This will be my dissertation. Collect some data, look at it, and then find the knowledge. Okay. I tried that, even though my advisor suggested not to, and he turned out to be right. Because it's hard to discover knowledge in data, especially when you don't know what you're looking for. What do I mean by discovering knowledge? Well, we can describe it. It goes by various names. Some people refer to it as data mining, some of it knowledge discovery, machine learning, pattern recognition, statistical learning. Essentially, means the same thing. Now, some of you can say, well, no, you know, data mining is just one step of the knowledge discovery process, and it would be cool. But for the most part, it's all concerned with coming up with ways to extract knowledge, find patterns in data. A lot of you represent, I mean, this is an interdisciplinary area. This is why this program is so rich in people's experiences, because we bring a lot to the table. We each have our own set of goggles that we're trying to look at the problem for. And so in this talk, I want to talk hopefully about the whole process, and maybe either please all of you or none of you. I'm going to define knowledge discovery as the process of extracting previously unknown and potentially useful patterns inherent in data. We're probably going to find trivial examples of knowledge. We always find that, but we want the results that we find to be of use to a real person. And again, if you think about my mysterious figure motivating my graduate work, real people have real needs to look at this data and find something useful. What is a pattern? It's a subset of the data, or maybe it's a description of the subset of the data, or maybe it's a model of the subset of the data. Some description or model or equation or subset that is somehow useful that the person could not, under normal means, find within this large amount of data. It's a pattern. It's interesting. And another factor that I'm throwing into what is not the knowledge discovery, I'm from a very applied background, and so it's good to come up with clever algorithms, but it's better to find algorithms that people can actually use. And if you were here in the previous Google talk about the PageRank, there were some choices that they made in terms of, you know, I may sacrifice accuracy for speed. So there are always choices that come into play. Speed, accuracy, cost, pick two. So to me, that's also a factor of a knowledge discovery system. What is data? Last talk, the data was the the web pages that can, you know, contain the contents of the pages and the links to other pages. Well, on the CD, there was text, and there was audio, and there was computer network traffic. In order to input all of that different type of data into the system, it can be, it's nice to have one way to represent it. And a common way to represent a large variety of data is the vector space model. Each object, each document, or each image, or each cell has a variety of measurements taken on that. So the rows of the data matrix are the actual objects, the images, the text, the audio. The columns are the measurements on that object. So text mining, we have n documents, n rows, with q weights or scores for particular words or phrases. So q columns, q dimensional data set. Image analysis, computer network traffic. Each object could be protocol flows, and then the columns could be measurements or descriptions or breakdowns of that protocol flow. So with this vector space model, we can, it's kind of like a common way of representing a large number of data. So when I talk about the data, I'm talking about data in this form.
I'm sorry, I got confused on the very first line. There are q words or q weights for each word, and then how many?
So for a particular document, that document might have the word butter in it. And so the actual cell value for butter and document one might be some score, some weight. It might be a frequency, number of times that word appears in that document. And so there are q of these words that appear in that corpus. There are a lot of approaches for actually discovering or computing these found patterns. I'm not going to go into them, and someone, you know, this might be a good subtopic for another talk. A lot of the different statistical approaches, I'm more interested in the statistical variety. If you know a lot about your data, you know the densities, the class conditional densities, then Bayes theory, you know, shows you how to make an optimal classifier. If you don't know a lot about your data, which is probably more often than not, especially if you think about what was on that CD, if you have kind of known examples, so I have some measurements on a particular cell, and some of these cells are cancerous or not cancerous, then you know I've got a set of data with known labeling. So that's a supervised approach. And therefore, you know, I could have a parametric approach or a non-parametric approach. Unsupervised, I don't have these known labels. I don't know what's on that CD. I don't have templates to look for. I don't know. It's an unsupervised approach. In computer science, the canonical supervised approach would be to try to classify email. I've got some emails that are valid. I've got some emails that are spam. And can I make a classifier to try to differentiate the two? Maybe earlier approaches wrote rules for different types of viruses or different types of spam. And so when a new email comes into the system, I look up in my little dictionary of rules and I try to find a match, and if I find a match, then I can label that as spam. That works great as long as the incoming viruses or the incoming spams match what's in my little predefined dictionary. There are also probabilistic approaches, so I can take a more statistical look at things. But the important point of these types of approaches are, you know, supervised. I have known examples like that. Kind of know what I'm looking for, or at least I have a start. But if you listen to the news, we're all supposed to find the evildoers. That's our mission in life. It's kind of funny, riding around the Beltway, the 495 Beltway around Washington, D.C., you see the big digital signs that says, report suspicious activity. How do we know? Enron, probably some of you are familiar with the large company that kind of imploded from corruption. We'd like to know what might have been some early indicators of something going wrong at Enron. And so, you know, maybe we can look at, if we make a graph of people and the number of emails that they send to each other, can we somehow look at that data set and try to find events or indicators that something is going wrong that might help in the investigation or might help us in the future? Gary Grebe has worked on this, and I think will be here maybe later in the semester, so if you are interested in a specific example. But this is an unsupervised case. We don't know ahead of time what we're looking for. And this case of classifiers and knowledge discovery systems is more important to me. I didn't know what was on that CD of stuff, but I wanted to be able to find it, or at least something interesting. So there are a variety of approaches that we just talked about, techniques, methods. There are ways to evaluate those models and approaches, maybe reducing or minimizing the misclassification error. And for a given model and a given way of evaluating that model, maybe we want to try to optimize or pick the right parameters. All of this is involved with a knowledge discovery system. Also, like we talked about last lecture about Google, it's not just the actual PageRank algorithm, but it's how you implement it. They have many, many, many servers just to store the hyperlink matrix. How are you going to store all of your data? How are you going to store all of the representations of the data? Can you fit it all into any memory? These are issues. How are you going to say whether one document is similar to another document? Your distance metric or your similarity metric. The number of columns in our data set, our data space representation, the number of columns, Q, is for real world problems most often large, very large, high dimensional data. High dimensionality presents a lot of problems with traditional classification approaches. The curse of dimensionality is one such example. The data becomes very, very sparse in this Q-dimensional space. As Q gets very, very large, it's very, very hard to find representative examples for a given number n. Overfitting, you know, there's always a trade-off between model complexity and performance. We have real-world issues of missing and noisy data. There are patterns. Maybe we can define a global pattern just to search the entire database for. But maybe there are patterns in of interest in that data that aren't global, they're local. And we want to be able to extract out these local patterns from this high-dimensional data set. And also of interest to me is user involvement in the search. If you think about this CE example where you've got these users in a room and all they do is they take this pipe of data and they try to extract out something of interest in it, well, they have a lot of experience. They have a lot of experience that they might be able to input into this classification algorithm. It's more than just pushing a button and waiting for the answer. Maybe they can try to steer the results. I think that's actually going to be one of the workshops a little bit later in the semester, where user involvement in the search is of interest. Okay, so these are just some implementation issues. Yeah. Talking about the knowledge discovery process. It's not just this one component, the data mining component, where we're looking at a particular classifier. We've got the data. Maybe we want to take that data and have some subset that we actually want to use, a target data set. From this target data set in its raw form, maybe we have to do some pre-processing or something to fit it into this vector space model. Okay, maybe once we have the data in this vector space model, some of these features, some of the columns are not useful for classification. Maybe we want to pick some subset of the features or do some combination of the features to reduce the dimensionality and to improve the performance of our classifier. Once we get it into a form that we want, then we can actually do data mining. And then we'd have to evaluate the results. And often, this is not just a linear process. It's many, many iterations, and we may have to go back many, many stages and try again. But the end result will hopefully be some knowledge. So this is what I see as the knowledge discovery system. It's not just one little data mining piece. So, what's an example? This is just an example of the system. It's just more for ideas and to stimulate perhaps some of the later discussions. It's called the iterative denoising methodology, and here's a really high-level description of it. Process a set of high-dimensional data, perform a local structure-preserving projection into a low-dimensional space, provide a visualization and interaction interface, and partition and iteratively denoise. That captures what touches on every piece of the knowledge discovery system. It's for a user that can visualize this high-dimensional data, they can actually use it, and maybe there's a way for the user to interject themselves into the classification process. What's the basic idea? Here's what I'm calling an iterative denoising tree. We saw trees yesterday. But if you can imagine all of my data at the root of this tree, and all of the data at the root of this tree, it's very high dimensional, it's very noisy. That's why we're trying to discover knowledge in the first place, because it's not obvious what the useful patterns are in that noisy, complex data set. But if we have some way to take this high-dimensional data and reduce dimensionality somehow, ideally preserving relationships that exist in this high-dimensional space, preserve them once we project into a lower-dimensional space, then maybe we can apply some of our traditional algorithms to work on this lower-dimensional space that the user can visualize and play with. One interesting component is that, so I have all of my data here, and I can reduce the dimensionality, and I can somehow partition or cluster or divide the data. And again, this is unsupervised, so I don't have existing templates to match against. But somehow, in this lower dimensional representation, I can maybe cluster the items somehow. And then, this initial data matrix, the values were in the cells of this particular document and this particular word, these values are the features that we're actually going to compute when we're doing this partitioning. Well, maybe the features that were useful to partition the data from when everyone is involved into these three child nodes, and then we're going to do the same process again for this subset of data, maybe the features that were useful here are different than the features that were useful here. So corpus-dependent feature extraction means that we're going to take another look at the features that are important to these guys, which are likely different than the features that were important here. If the features were important throughout the entire space, we could do a global search and be done. But we want to extract out these local patterns of interest. And so we need to take another look at the features that are important here. And we keep doing this iteration until eventually, here the nodes are noisy, And we keep extracting out and partitioning until eventually somehow we get to some sort of more homogeneous, less noisy nodes. These are our leaves. These are what we say, or you know, we're done. And someone can look at these more homogeneous nodes and hopefully more clearly find out something useful. So I was a computer science student, and so they made me stick a flowchart into my dissertation. But if you think about it, this flowchart maps essentially that triangle process flow that I showed on the previous slide. If you got your data, it's in its raw form, and somehow we want to extract out from that data a representation that I can use in digital form. I don't want to have to go back to the original data set. Maybe I can extract out some summary metrics that I never have to take another look at the original complex data. And from this initial summary metrics for all of the features in the root node, I'm going to compute some sort of feature scores. What are the values that go into these cells? And then I'm going to do this denoising, whatever that is, making that tree. And then after each iteration of taking the data in its high-dimensional form, reducing dimensionality, and doing partitioning, maybe that's a good place for the user to take a look and maybe steer what's going on. If the user can maybe, if only has to compute one path of the tree, that will save a lot in performance. Or maybe they see some relationships in the data that, based on their subjective experience, they can modify, and maybe they can make some adjustments. Well, then we continue on and build the entire iterative denoising tree. What's in that denoising box? Well, we need, and I mentioned that one of the important components in a knowledge discovery system is how do you know when objects are close to each other or far away from each other? We need some measure of proximity, similarities, distances. If you can represent the documents as a vector, then I can look at the cosine of the angle between two different documents. If the angle is zero, that means those documents are very similar. If the angles are orthogonal, then those documents are not similar to each other. But I can choose some way of finding similarities between them, or distances between the objects. So I have a way of computing distances between the objects, and I can use that to somehow take this high-dimensional data with a large number of columns in my data matrix and reduce the dimensionality somehow, embed it into some lower dimensional space where I have columns now. I have D columns instead of Q columns, where D is much smaller than Q. Once I'm in this lower dimensional space, I have a host of traditional algorithms that I can apply, such as k-means clustering, if I want to partition based on, in an unsupervised case. Okay. That's what I'm calling. That's what's going on in that denoising box. How do you do that in embedding? There are a variety of ways. I showed yesterday principal components analysis, a way of embedding. Well, Laplacian eigenmaps, and maybe you'll talk about that later, some of the folks who are talking about spectral methods. Laplacian eigenmaps is a non-linear dimensionality reduction technique, whereas principal components analysis is linear. It distorts the geometry in such a way that it has some types of clustering. How do you do that? Well, I've got all of my documents, and I can create an adjacency matrix by saying this document is adjacent or close to some value k. I can choose k of 5. I can say, okay, this document is close to these 5 other documents. And if I can compute these new k-nearest neighbor, for example, for all of the documents, I can get an adjacency matrix, the graph depending on the value of k, the graph might be connected. If the graph is connected, I can compute this Laplacian of the graph, and the d smallest non-zero eigenvectors, or eigenvectors corresponding to non-zero eigenvalues, is my lower dimensional embedding. I'm calling it a Fiedler space, because Fiedler did some work on showing how the smallest eigenvector is useful for classification. And not only is d much smaller than q, it's reduced in dimensionality, but if I take the smallest two of these eigenvectors, I have a way of visualizing this high-dimensional complex data set for the user. Let's see an example. Maybe you're all familiar with the Science News publication, but we took 1,047 of these Science News articles and had a human just try to bend them into different types of articles. So we have from this corpus of 1,047 documents, there were 54 anthropology documents, 121 astronomy, 72 behavioral sciences, 137 earth sciences, 205 life sciences, 60 math and computer science, 280 medicine, and 118 physics documents. So that's the number of rows in our data matrix. What are the columns? The columns were n-grams. What is an n-gram? It's like a root of a word. So run and running, the root would be run. So that's a monogram for all these words. And we computed the monograms of the words that appear in the entire corpus, and there were 32,130 words, roots. So our matrix, our data matrix, was 1,047 by 32,130. And you can kind of see that this is probably a sparse matrix because not all of these words are in every document. But it's a very large document, I mean a very large matrix, and the number of features is much larger than the number of objects, which can cause problems. Very high dimensional data. So let's look at, remember the iterative denoising tree? Let's look at a representation of that tree. And if you kind of tilt your head, you can see the tree being grown. I've got each one of these boxes represents a collection of objects. So in the first box, I've got all of the documents there. I've got, and here it's an ordered list of the bins that the human kind of divided those documents into. We're not using those labels. This is all unsupervised, but it's just so we can kind of see what's going on. And so these class counts show the number of, so 54 anthropology documents, 121 astronomy. You can see the numbers of each class, pseudo class, in each node. So here's the root node. We take our high dimensional representation, we compute the adjacency matrix, we find the d smallest eigenvectors, and then we do k-means clustering. We make three clusters. So you can see now, well, I mean, there are 140 documents in this cluster, 660 in this one, 247 in that one. You see anything else of interest? Well, there were 280 medicine documents in the root node, and now there are 201 in this node, 73 in this, and 6 in that. More of the medicine documents got stuck in that node. Maybe you can try to imagine patterns, but it's kind of hard to see from this representation. Nevertheless, we can try again. And for each each child node from the first iteration. We can also reduce its dimensionality. Recomputing, doing corpus-dependent feature extraction, recomputing the features that might be important for just the 140 documents that are in that node. Maybe they're different than what was originally important at the root node. And so each child node, we can keep doing the partition. Do we see anything interesting here? Well, there were 201 medicine documents at this node, and now there are 174 here. And the other types of documents that are in this node, I mean, there are only 30 astronomy documents, not that many, dominated by medicine documents, at least with that node. So is that interesting? I don't know. This one, 102 life sciences documents seem to dominate this node. Something's going on, but I want to make something user-friendly. Help the user. I don't know if this does it. But we can try something else. We can take those two, yes?
I was wondering how you determine the number of nodes to choose at each iteration.
That was just an example.
So you just randomly chose three groups of them?
Yeah, I like binary, but for that example, I did three.
Does all this combination of Laplace and Eddy maps, dimensionality reduction, and clustering, it leads you to contradiction? Because Laplace and Eddy maps specifically, but many other dimensionality reduction algorithms, assumes uniform distribution of data that you're trying to embed in lower dimensional space. And the clustering, on the other hand, assumes different regions of highly dense data and regions with not very highly dense data to find the clustering border.
Right.
Does it lead you to some kind of contradiction using dimensionality reduction and clustering later on?
I don't have a way to quantify that, but from what I've seen, yeah. When you get to a small number of high dimensional documents or nodes, and then you try to do dimensionality reduction, you know, I'm less impressed with the results.
Well, perhaps that will be discussed in some of the later talks.
But yeah, that's a very good point. So we have the previous way of representing.
Can I make a remark on that, on the question?
Sure.
Usually if you take Laplace and Eigenmaps emphasize clusters because there's a space in between clusters with a lower density. So it won't make an accurate embedding, but what it will do is actually
so if I take the two smallest of my lower dimensional eigenvectors, non-zero, and I display the data, make a scatter plot, and then I apply a color to each object according to its class. You know, maybe it's subjective, but I see something interesting, and I see a lot more information from this representation than I did at this representation. The greens, for example, are medicine documents. And black, for example, are astronomy documents. The numbers represent their partition. So partition 1, partition 2, partition 3. We have partition 1, partition 2, and partition 3. So the color represents class, the number represents partition, and the location represents these objects plotted in this lower dimensional space. Can a user see something interesting? Well, I found it interesting that the astronomy documents and the medicine documents, which of all of these categories seem to be the furthest apart in terms of what they talk about, are the furthest apart in this two-dimensional scatter plot. That was kind of interesting. And you know, maybe there are like bands of colors that are That's interesting, but that's just the root node. Let's look at this child node. Well, it's a little unclear exactly what we see, but we do see at least clusters of article types. So this magenta is a cluster of behavioral sciences, and we have lots of oranges and yellows, so anthropology and life sciences. Here's some light grays, earth sciences. That's kind of interesting. I can look at also this other child node, and again we see a similar clustering and grouping that we did in the root node. So again, you know, the medicine and the astronomy. We see a large contingent of the life sciences, anthropology folks, which could be considered to be similar to each other. And then this third child node, we get this representation. And I found it interesting that my eyes see kind of a three-armed structure there. And this arm, I see astronomy, physics, and earth sciences. This arm, I see medicine, life sciences, and anthropology. And this arm, I see dominated by math and computer science. Well, hard sciences, soft sciences, and abstract sciences. Bound to irritate somebody in the room. But you could make that label of how these documents were clustered. That's kind of interesting. But you can say, well, you know, but then in this computer science, this abstract sciences arm, I see, you know, physics. You know, there's physics tends to be scattered in all the different disciplines. So we've got some physics here, and physics here. I see some physics here in this abstract sciences, along with maybe a couple anthropology or life sciences. What's going on? You're not clustering, right? Because the colors don't match. Well, maybe. But also remember that this initial binning, which determined these colors of these documents, was done by a human. Just saying, hey, I read this and maybe I'm tired and I think that's a computer science document article, and I think this is an anthropology article, and I think that medicine's over here, and heaven forbid that, you know, you actually have an article that kind of covers multiple disciplines, or could have been misbinned. You could also consider that binning into these different classes is maybe a high-level pattern of interest, and maybe there are smaller, more local patterns of interest that we might want to extract. And so I took a look at this arm, this section of this set of documents, and then in specific, I looked at this small subset. So I've got some computer science, and I've got orange is life science, and some blue is physics. And I just looked at the titles of these articles that were in this small cluster. And math enthusiast wins talent search, chinks in digital armor, exploiting faults to break smart card crypto systems, neutrinos to buckyballs, 10 talents tower, how to trick other people's computers into solving your math problems. That's kind of like a gaming slash competition localized clustering that the initial person who was bidding these articles into these broad categories didn't see. That's kind of neat. But this is all just an example, just to show you kind of a knowledge discovery system and how it might be useful to a user and do the whole life cycle of the whole knowledge discovery process. Yeah, that was the whole point.